Hello and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. I'm Keith Parent. The wheels are turning again at the Joint Industrial Complex in Kaesong, 5 months after Pyongyang shut it down in the height of tensions with Seoul. More than 50,000 North Koreans were withdrawn while South Korean owners were denied access to their factories. But eventually, after a series of delicate negotiations, an agreement was reached to reopen Kaesong, and there's now a renewed sense of optimism about its future. Tom Maddock has the story.
The mood was one of relief as more than 800 South Korean managers and workers crossed into North Korea. They're hopeful they can revive their businesses some 5 months after work was suspended.
I'm very happy that Kaesong is reopened. I'm glad that I'm able to work again and hope all works out well in the future.
While the restart of operations has been welcomed, businesses are cautiously optimistic about the future. The North and South have set up a joint committee in an effort to prevent another closure. In the meantime, however, the 120 or so South Korean companies say the suspension has cost them about $920 million. Many returning workers say they were hurt badly by the closure of the industrial park.
It has been very tough. I'm sure my company's been having a hard time, but personally, it was really tough. From now on, I hope everything works out well, that the complex becomes revitalized again, and everyone works for a vibrant Kaesong industrial complex.
For North Korea, Kaesong provides an important source of hard currency, and workers pull in around $86 million per year. Dr. Robert E. Kelly is an associate professor of international relations at Pusan National University in South Korea. He says reopening Kaesong is a move of substance for the North, but says its benefits for South Korea are less certain.
For the South, it's kind of a mixed bag. My own sense is this is a mistake. I actually wrote an article about 4 months ago at the height of the spring nuclear crisis in which I said I thought it was not a bad thing that Kaesong was closed, that it had become like a cash cow to support the northern nuclear program particularly. So for the South, I'm not really sure why they did it. I do think that Southern opinion tends to think that, well, you know, this engaging North Korea is really important. We have to find some way to sort of draw them out and that we shouldn't just be sort of stuck in this knives drawn kind of confrontation with them, and that some kind of interaction like family reunions and Southern tourism in the North and this industrial zone, all this is important. So, you know, there's strong Southern support for it.
As part of the joint agreement to reopen Kaesong, South Korea made it clear to the North the doors of the industrial complex must be open to foreign investment. But Robert Kelly says that's unlikely to happen anytime soon.
The kind of safeguards that foreign investors would expect from the North Koreans would be significantly higher than those that Southern firms have demanded. You know, Southern firms can always fall back on the Southern government and say, hey, I just got expropriated, or, you know, the North Korean military just took all my plant and infrastructure and, you know, I'm on my surplus or whatever, you owe me $50 million or something like that. And the South Korean government is reasonably open to that kind of stuff because, again, the driver behind Kaesong isn't really economic, it's political. I mean, if the South Korean firms really wanted cheap labor, they could all go to, you know, Cambodia. It's really politics that's pushing this, right? So for foreign firms, though, they're not really going to have that kind of safety net. They're not going to really have that kind of moral driver to get them into the zone. It really isn't going to be a straightforward question of can North Korea actually provide a business environment that would be safe and respected and worth their time.
He says the restarting of Kaesong is admirable and that there's strong public and political support from within South Korea.
Right, the real question then is, are the North Koreans actually going to reach back? Are they going to make any changes? Are they going to loosen up on the rules about the people who work there, for example? Are they actually going to pay the people who work there in a hard currency, for example? You know, will they allow the people who work there maybe to set up some local shops or something like that to create some synergies from this place? Or are they going to continue to shake it down as basically a cash cow for dollars? And that's what I really want to see before I share the kind of the enthusiasm of the optics, which I agree are very nice, but the real question is the substance.
South Korean factory managers will now assess the state of production lines as they prepare to welcome the return of North Korean workers later this week.
Staying on the subject of North Korea, the DPRK has lashed out at the findings of a United Nations inquiry headed by the former Australian High Court Judge Michael Kirby, describing it as a fabrication. Pyongyang says the report is a fabrication and the allegations of systematic human rights abuses in the DPRK have been made by what they called human scum. Mr. Kirby has been telling the Human Rights Council in Geneva how his inquiry heard horrific accounts of sexual abuse, torture and murder from witnesses. Mark Willisey has the story.
It's believed that between 100 and 200,000 North Koreans are in prison camps. And during his report to the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva, Michael Kirby compared this vast gulag to the Nazi extermination camps of World War II.
We think of the testimony of a young man imprisoned from birth and living on rodents and lizards and grass to survive, witnessing the public execution of his mother and his brother. We think of the testimony of a young woman forcibly repatriated and imprisoned for leaving the DPRK, describing how she witnessed a female prisoner forced to drown her own baby in a bucket.
Since the former Australian High Court judge was named to head this inquiry into North Korean human rights abuses, the regime in Pyongyang has refused to cooperate or to offer testimony. And it denounces those North Korean defectors who have fronted the inquiry as nothing more than human scum. Kim Yong-ho is Pyongyang's man at its Geneva mission.
My delegation totally rejects the oral update by the commission, by the so-called Commission of Inquiry on the human rights situation in the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. The oral update is another copy of faked materials on the situation of human rights in my country.
Already under international sanctions over its missile and nuclear programs, Pyongyang fears this human rights inquiry is yet another instrument to isolate it further. Michael Kirby insists his commission of inquiry is neither prosecutor nor judge. But it seems the Australian has enough evidence already to prove that North Korea is one of the world's most horrific human rights violators.
The individual testimonies emerging from the public hearings, of which these are just instances, do not represent isolated cases. They are representative of large-scale patterns that may constitute systematic and gross violations of human rights.
That is no surprise. What will really count is how the United Nations responds to Michael Kirby's final report.
And that was Mark Willisy reporting. We now move to India. The New Delhi Police Force has taken the initiative to offer specialist training on dealing with rape cases and the sexual abuse of children. We have this report from Mario Krishna, who gives us a special report on the access that he had to the training session, which comes against the background of the verdict and sentencing of India's most notorious rape in recent years.
The city's new police commissioner, Bhim Singh Basi, is imparting special lessons on gender sensitization and how to investigate rape cases to his senior colleagues. Some are in charge of specialized units like the Special Women's Cell, Crime Branch and Economic Offences Wing.
Capacity building is a continuous exercise, and any officer who is in service cannot afford to remain ignorant about the latest things which are happening around. And this sort of effort has to be made by a large force like ours, which is assigned responsibility of maintaining law and order in the city. It must start from the top. Once they are aware of the relevant issues, they can disseminate the same in their interaction with their subordinate officers.
Training includes knowledge of new laws, such as the protection of children from sexual offences. This law provides for very stringent punishments for sexual abuse, molestation and rape of children. It also provides for a framework for protection to children of such heinous offences. The aim of the police program is to improve general policing in the capital streets. With a total strength of more than 80,000 personnel, Delhi Police is one of the largest metropolitan police in the world. SBS Tyagi, a deputy commissioner of police, explains why these programs are important.
Since changes are taking place so often and so quickly, we need to know what exactly is to be done on the ground, because we are the people who implement law on the ground. People are aware that these are the things, these are the offences they need to report. Prior to the changes, everybody has a tendency to brush it under the carpet.
Suman Goyal, an assistant commissioner of police, agrees.
Yeah, it's very relevant and it's very good also, because it's kind of knowledge update. No doubt it will be good for our further working.
There has been a 16% jump in the number of reported rapes nationally in India in the 5 years ending 2012, and a 902% jump since 1971, according to police records. In the first 6 months of this year, reported rapes in New Delhi soared to 806 from 330 in the same period a year earlier. The police say the rise reflects greater confidence in reporting assaults coming in the wake of the sentencing of the four accused who were given the death penalty last week for the gang rape of a paramedical student. The police top brass have taken this program seriously. Deepak Mishra is a special commissioner of police.
With the changing society, one has to keep up pace with everything because system is dynamic. Police also cannot be presumed to be a static one. We have to respond to the immediate needs of the society, so we need to be very sensitive about it.
S.N. Srivastava, another special commissioner in charge of training, says there's an urgent need for improving the skill sets of senior officers.
There are new acts which are coming up. There are amendments taking place, good work, good investigation which has taken place. And also there are areas where the officers should develop better understanding. So in these areas, you know, the senior officers also need to be updated. Just as a doctor or advocate, he also updates himself. Even though he is 60 years old, a very senior man, but still he does update. So will a police officer update himself?
The government's plans to improve policing also include measures to recruit more women, who make up just under 7% of the force. Murali Krishnan.
In the Philippines, life in the southern city of Zamboanga is said to be turning slowly to normal after more than a week of what's been described as the worst fighting between Muslim rebels and government troops in years. Those rebels who have not already given themselves up or been captured have been given an ultimatum: surrender unconditionally or suffer the consequences. Next, Richard Erwar speaks to General Domingo Tatan, the Philippine military spokesman.
There is still a small group of about 70 of them, with more or less about 20 plus hostages are still held out in specific areas, about 2 or 3 hectares in size in Zamboanga City. But the better news about this is that about 178 hostages have been already rescued. They have been processed and reunited with their respective families. And of the Miswari MNLF faction, there are a total of 179 of them. 86 were killed and 93 have been captured or arrested. Normalcy is going back to Zamboanga City. The flights are back. 2 flights of commercial airlines will be back today.
Now, you mentioned that group of hostages that are still being held. Are those the only remaining hostages, or could there be others elsewhere in the city?
Yes, Richard, by our assessment of the operating troops on the ground, estimate that there are about 20 or so more hostages based on the testimonies of those who were rescued. And we still want to have our calibrated response on this in order that they may not be brought into any crossfire with the MNLF Miswari faction.
Now, can you tell me about the rebels that have given themselves up? I understand that one group was persuaded to do so by Police Chief Jose Chiquito Maleo, and there's some suggestion that he may at one stage have been kidnapped during that process. I mean, is that right, or was he always negotiating freely with these rebels before he persuaded them to give up?
Well, suffice it to say, Richard, that this was a police operations conducted. I am with the Armed Forces of the Philippines. But yes, after this incident happened, 23 members of the Miswari MNLF faction surrendered. And I think they are now being processed and investigated as we speak today, and in order to determine the confirmatory reports on the incident itself.
Now, in terms of civilian deaths, my understanding, I think, is that there have been 7 so far. And I know the message from President Aquino, who was in Zamboanga for a number of days, was very clear to the military to protect civilians at all costs. I mean, do you consider that mission has been successful?
Yes, Richard. I wouldn't relegate it to a lesser degree, but there were only 7, I'm not saying only in the strict sense of it, but there were 7 fatalities from the civilian side, and this is a big effort on us really to be discerning. And most of these 7, or if not all, were killed not by a crossfire, but by the Miswari faction themselves. So we're looking into this. And the thing is that the hostages, which we estimated at the onset was about something like 200, we have now 178 rescued from them. So we believe that though tedious in a manner of speaking, but we were able to undertake this very successfully.
So how much longer would you expect the military operation to go on for now?
Well, as you mentioned, Richard, in your introduction, that if the rebels would give up this very minute, that would end the situation. But then again, we don't want to be complacent and having a false sense of security. We want to clear the areas of any unexploded ordnance or probably IEDs and other war material that will be hazardous to the evacuees when they return home. And also, when the firefight have subsided, there are no more fires from the MNLF faction of Biswari.
And can you see any signs of a political settlement being reached with this particular group, at this breakaway group of rebels?
Well, government has been very adamant in saying that they have to give up their arms, lay down their arms, submit themselves to the rule of law. A lot of people, we have about 109 evacuees in 35 evacuation centers. The economy and business activity of Zamboanga City has been disrupted for the past 10 days. Somebody has to be responsible for this on the legal aspect.
And if you've just tuned in, you're listening to PCJ Radio International's Focus Asia Pacific. Pakistan's outgoing envoy to Papua New Guinea and Indonesia says officials in Jakarta seem confused and jittery about the new Australian government's asylum seeker policies. Mian Selanu left Jakarta this week after stepping down as ambassador to both countries. Before his departure, he urged Australia's Prime Minister-elect Tony Abbott to take a more humanitarian approach to refugees and to review the deals done by Kevin Rudd's outgoing Labour government. George Roberts reports from Jakarta.
As Pakistan's ambassador to Indonesia and Papua New Guinea, Mr. Sanaullah has quietly observed regional developments.
Those who are reaching Australian waters by boat or by any other means are a desperate lot.
Now he's leaving the post, he's free to give his view on what Australia's asylum seeker policies appear to be aimed at.
Just to ensure electability with the domestic politicians and voters. That is my concern.
Of the 11,000 asylum seekers and refugees currently registered in Indonesia, 800 are from Pakistan. Scores more have made it to Australia. But Mr. Sanaullah says his government recently brought all political parties together and they're working to end the sectarian violence that people have fled.
Because the government has to provide protection to each and every individual, irrespective of their creed, ethnicity, religion. Sometimes we have failed. It is a sorry state of affairs, but government is trying its best. Pakistan still has the largest population of refugees. We are poorest as compared to Australia as a country.
Mr. Sanaullah says his reading is that Indonesia won't like Tony Abbott's policies. He says Indonesian officials are confused and jittery about the new Prime Minister's approach to asylum seekers, but it's up to the two countries to work them through. As for the PNG deal Mr. Abbott is inheriting, the former ambassador thinks that's inhumane.
Basically, when they say whosoever come by boat would not be accepted, even if his or her reason is genuine. I object to that.
Among his concerns is the lack of freedom of expression in PNG.
Because there has been recently a move approved by the majority in the parliament that no other religion would be allowed to be practiced publicly.
The departing diplomats also worried about where in PNG asylum seekers are being sent.
And there are no infrastructures, no education, no health facilities. Mortality rate for women during birth is highest in the world. How they would educate themselves to become citizens, good citizens of that country.
Mr. Sanaullah hopes the policy of indiscriminately banishing asylum seekers from Australia is reviewed.
From Australia, we expect, as they expect from other countries, to pay attention to international rules and best practices.
He says that means giving protection to those who deserve it.
We now move to Tonga, where there's a dispute over the safety of the country's MA-60 aircraft. Real Tonga's MA-60 aircraft was a gift from the Chinese government to Tonga, but its checkered safety record has caused an alarm in Auckland, New Zealand. The planes are not registered by any Western government, and New Zealand has put millions of dollars in tourism aid funding on hold until it is satisfied with the safety of the aircraft. On the ground, there's increasing dissatisfaction with its performance. One passenger with the tale is ABC reporter Lisa Kingsbury, who was on holiday when she got stranded. She speaks next to Geraldine Coutts.
Well, we'd landed in Nuku'alofa and we were based on the main island and planning to fly north to Vavao. What actually happened was we'd been told by our accommodation providers on the North Island to actually contact the airline before the flight just to confirm the time, because apparently in the last few months they've been changing the time of flights and as a result a lot of passengers have been missing them. So we contacted the airline quite a few hours before our flight and we were told that it was cancelled but not given any further information. So we were told to go into the Real Tonga office based on Nuku'alofa, so we did, and they informed us that the pilot had been rushed to hospital and they were trying to replace the captain and they were trying to get in contact with a local captain to actually fly the plane. The weather was perfect. It was a bright, sunny day. There was no rain. And throughout the day, this is a story that they kept telling us. More and more passengers were being delayed, obviously, at this point. And then we were told that they were grounded for another day, the next day. Told that the captain was still sick, but that he should be up and running. And then weather, because the rain rolled in the next day, had caused the flights to be grounded. So this kind of started to manifest. We were stuck in Nuku'alofa for more than 2 nights. And then we hopped on the plane on the Wednesday, and as we got on, the exit sign of the plane fell off and they couldn't put it back on, so they just took the exit sign off on the plane. As we ascended off the runway, water started running from the cabins above us, and it actually, we were sitting in the emergency aisle and it actually landed straight on top of me, unfortunately. But it has never been, I've never been on such an anxious flight. And I think the fact that the pilot had been sick, combined with all of the discussion around the MA-60, had caused all of the passengers that were delayed to be quite nervous. And everyone was talking about the safety issues and whether or not they were actually getting on the plane. I've never seen so many people pay attention to the safety demonstration. It was seriously like meerkats popping up. No one missed the safety demonstration. So it was an incredibly tense flight. The flight itself was fine, but we flew on a plane that actually carried less passengers from Fiji or had the capacity to carry less passengers. And the way I felt on both of my flights on the MA-60 versus the way that I felt on the flight from Fiji to Tonga is, you know, you just can't compare them. I was much more comfortable on the international flight than I was on the internal flight.
And people aren't being compensated. The airline isn't paying for this extended stay in any of their ports because of the problems they're having with the MA-60.
Well, it depends on where we were based. So we were lucky in the sense that we were based in Nuku'alofa. The accommodation that we had booked had no extension for us to stay. They were fully booked. So the airline did actually put us up. But there was about, it'd probably be about 30 of us in this particular hotel, and I'd say maybe 20 of us were being put up by the airline, and then another 10 who'd just been staying in that hotel had to pay their own way. And the same problem was happening in Vavao. It was the same situation where hostels are just refusing to take passengers in because the airline hasn't been paying the bills. So now the passengers are having to say, okay, if they don't pay, we will. And that's basically what's been happening. So without travel insurance, you would be out of pocket. But if people do have travel insurance, of course, that should cover these. But there is some question as to whether New Zealand travel insurance providers fully cover for this MA-60 because of the warnings that have occurred.
And what are the locals thinking? Because it's not just tourism to them, it's transport.
Yeah, to be honest, there's two important parts to the internal flights. One is the milk run, so deliveries, making sure that, you know, fresh food or whatever needs to be delivered quickly gets to those outer islands. The other is obviously the tourism dollar. And I spoke to quite a lot of tourism providers who they say it's absolutely crippling them. The people on our flight we'd become friends with were either Australian or New Zealanders. And I can tell you now that the tension and the concern that existed around the flight, and I think it was valid concern. I was definitely uncomfortable, but pretending that I wasn't. I think that that will now go back to all of their families, all of their friends. If something bad happens, you tell 20 people. If something good happens, you tell 5. So their concern is more for the next season rather than the end of this season, although it is having impacts this season. It's more that people won't book next season because they'll be aware of the safety concerns and have these real-life experiences from their friends.
And do people have a choice of flying on the MA60s or waiting for another bus, as it were?
There's a ferry, but it's not overly consistent either. It was meant to be leaving one of the days that we were there, and it had been booked out because there'd been a sporting event happening in the Pacific. So the ferry was taken up by that. So passengers that didn't want to get on the MA60 didn't have a choice. If they wanted to get to these islands, basically. So we obviously took the chance, and it was probably the most daunting hour flight. And on the way back, it was the same. We had a situation where we decided we should call them just in case they'd changed the flight, and we did. Just in the nick of time, they changed the flight and brought it forward an hour. So we almost missed our flight back to Nuku'alofa because we hadn't been told that our flight had actually been changed. So even if you take out the, you know, the safety concerns around the MA60, there are significant concerns just around passengers being there on time and missing their flight. And they're not carrying the flights at full capacity. It's a 60-seater plane, and there would have been probably 30 to 35 people on our plane. And we've been told the reason that there is only one captain is because it's a Chinese captain who's teaching the locals how to fly this particular plane. And because it's such a new plane, they're not trained to the capacity of being able to fly independently without this training. So I can fully understand that. And the Real Tonga staff were great with us. But of the people that I spoke to, there were so many different horror stories of, you know, people having to pay themselves or being bumped off flights or being told they were on a flight that they didn't get on. So, it was very, very different to what I'm used to, that's for sure.
And with that, we end this edition of Focus Asia Pacific. If you want to contact us, our email address is focus@pcjmedia.com. Catch another edition of the program Sunday at 1330 UTC on 11,835 kilohertz for listeners in Southeast Asia and East Asia. For PCJ Radio International, I'm Keith Perron. We'll see you soon. Bye for now.